Many of you, of course, took part last Sunday in the event we held with Swami Kriyananda at the Foothill Theater, which was really a marvelous time. If you weren't able to attend, you can go to our website and you can see the program, at the recording of the program. As it happened, we were in the theater, which held a little over 900 people, and it was mostly full. And the theater is sort of bowl-shaped so that people were kind of spread uphill like this. And because Swami Kriyananda is a little unstable on his feet, he's 86 years old now, as he himself described it, he says, from the neck up, he's fine. But the rest of him is wobbly, to use his own words. And so when he started to rise to get up from the chair where he'd been speaking, go off stage, David and I came out to help him. And after he was already standing, and after the whole audience was already standing, he remembered that he'd intended to sing a few songs. But he decided that he didn't want to sit, and since he was incapable of standing steadily on his own, or let's put it this way, we weren't about to risk whether he could or not, I just stayed on his arm. And then I began to realize that I was going to be standing next to him the whole time this next 5 minutes of the program went forth, in which, of course, he was the feature, but I was the post, you know, that had to keep him there. But what it gave me, of course, was just a marvelous opportunity to see the whole thing from the front and see everybody's faces relating to his. And then in the end, when everybody sang together, all 900 people or so, all just singing back. And if there's ever been a question in my mind about how wide and varied the manifestations of God are, it was a perfect moment, because it wasn't a random crowd by any means. We were all gathered for one purpose, and in fact, by the end of the program, all of the attention was very strongly focused in the consciousness that was right next to mine, both in his giving and people giving back to him. But yet, everybody was doing it differently. And I'm not a great singer in any case, and Swamiji was wearing a lavalier microphone on his breastbone right here, and I wasn't sure how sensitive that was, and I certainly didn't want my voice to come out stronger than his, so I just mouthed the words with full enthusiasm without letting a sound come out, you know, just so that if his voice was mic'd, which in fact it was, it would be the only one that people heard. And somehow or another, just even, I always joke anyway about being a singer. I say I'm a better actor than a singer. So I know how to act like a singer, even when I can't really sing. So I acted like a singer. And some people commented how lovely it was to see me singing up there, which I went, you know, about. But it was so, there was such a unique and yet unified quality to the whole room. Manifested by Swamiji's unique consciousness, certainly, but the quality of his consciousness that people responded to was the way in which it connected with each of our own. It's very interesting. Swamiji once remarked that one of the reasons people will often say to him after he gives a talk, "You answered all my questions. You know, are you in my mind? How did you know what I was thinking?" But his answer was actually very interesting. There's two answers to that. One is that when you're speaking spontaneously, you actually literally are feeling the thoughts and ideas of other people, and that's where your inspiration comes from. As Swamiji says, an audience doesn't appreciate the extent to which they influence the presentation. Because if the audience is flat and uninterested, or resistant. Swamiji said one of the worst cities in the world to lecture in is London. I've never had the experience of lecturing there, so I don't really know. But he said the British are so skeptical, especially about spiritual things. He says you spend the entire evening, as he said, bringing them from skepticism to zero. You don't ever really get to build very much. In America, what I find happens is that Americans are extremely heart-oriented. But at the same time, we have this American shrewdness, is the only way I can think about it. And we really don't like to be conned. We don't like to be taken advantage of. We don't really like to get swept into the crowd. So Americans will enter into a spiritual experience often with with a tremendous amount of enthusiasm and really have this wonderful experience. And people will say afterwards, you know, my life was changed and so on, and then you never see them again. Never. Because one goes home and then begins to think about it and sort of wonders, you know, what was really happening. And there was a certain inaccuracy in what was said there, and, you know, someone afterwards, and just all these different ways that we pick it apart. And it's unfortunate. But the fact of the matter is, and I'll just say a word in favor of America, when Americans decide, they're really solid about things. And we, you know, we know how to get things done. We just go, we're practical, as Master said. When Yogananda came to America to bring these teachings of India, he said it's so well known in India, and people have the belief in karma, and they have the belief in reincarnation, and these long spans of time. You know, our country is so young. We have no history because, yes, there were native peoples here, but we landed in America and we just basically wiped out what was there and started over, not to our credit, but nonetheless, that's what we did. So everything about America is what we made. We don't have anything to be proud of when you look backwards. You go to Florence, for example, and people are proud because they live in the city where Michelangelo carved the David. The first time I went to Europe, I was already in my 30s, and I was just so puzzled by that. I would be looking at someone and think, what did Michelangelo have to do with you? How can you possibly be claiming any importance just because you're walking on the same sidewalk? And I didn't realize how American I was. You know, if you're a fish swimming in water, you don't know. We have nothing to be proud of except what we've done ourselves in business since 1995. You know, it's just like really just a fabulous reality. But in India, Master said, where they have thousands, literally thousands of years of history, and in fact, India until recently had fallen on hard times. Now they're pulling themselves out with an admirable zeal. You know, oddly, India is the most wealthy country in the world. That's, of course, why England went over to dominate it. And gradually, England became the most wealthy country in the world, and India became one of the poorest. What a coincidence. And jewels that used to be in the Taj Mahal are now in the crown of the King of England. You know, there's a little bit of a relationship here, but this is the way things play themselves out. So the Indians have this long history to think about. And so when it's talked to them about realizing God, Master said, unfortunately, one, they think they have all the time in the world to do it. And the second thing is they know how hard it is. But when it came to America, we had no idea how hard it was. And so Master said, okay, you know, meditate, do Kriya Yoga. You can realize God in this lifetime. And Americans said, sure, why not? Just like that. And then with that kind of enthusiasm, well, built the whole movement of spirituality, which is really emanating from the West, primarily from America, primarily from the Bay Area. Everything comes from here. It doesn't always stick, but it starts. You know, this is one of the most open-minded, creative, expansive, you know, areas on the planet. That's why people keep rushing here. But the fact of the matter is, no matter what cultural context we come from, no matter where we get our self-worth, no matter what language, the color of our skin, and all of this, we're all just walking our own individual paths. For the first 8, almost 10 years of my spiritual life, I lived at Ananda Village, which is still Ananda Village. It's the first Ananda development, and still the largest and most highly developed. But I lived there when it was very primitive. And I lived in the monastery with a group of about a dozen women. It swelled and shrank over the period of time, but it was a core group. And our temple was this teepee that we'd made out of canvas and lined with plastic so that when the canvas got soaking wet, the plastic would keep the water out. We had to virtually crawl into it through this little opening. It was marvelous, absolutely marvelous. Not substantial in a material sense, but very substantial. Excuse me, in a spiritual sense. And every morning, we would go in there and the women would meditate together. And we would recite the poem Samadhi, some of the words of which are on the walls above us. That's where those words come from. And there would be this extraordinary sense of unified consciousness. And then we would recite the words to the poem Samadhi, which would talk about the complete dissolution of ego and the complete experience of all of cosmic consciousness. And in a peculiar way, it startled me. Every morning when I come out of that meditation and when I would walk out, I was still myself. I would sort of randomly wonder why one of those days I didn't end up being one of the other girls and just walk out in her body. Or even if I was walking out in mine, why I wasn't her karma, why I wasn't her destiny. And on one hand, of course, I mean, they've made comedy movies out of that very theme right now, where people get reversed. And there used to be fairy tales about identical twins separated at birth who would find themselves in each other's lives. And, you know, because it's a joke, it doesn't really happen. Because no matter how hard we work at it, there is this persistent individuality that just has us by the ankles, and we just cannot shake it off, no matter how hard we try. And spiritual life promises that we can transcend the limitations of that individuality. But even in infinite consciousness, the little self is still the little bubble, even when it merges in the ocean, still exists as a little bubble and can still be pulled out. Swami Kriyananda, on several times, I believe, during his most recent visit, mentioned that specific fact, speaking of it this way. If we pray to Jesus, if we pray to Yogananda, if we pray to Saint, whoever you're going to become, Saint, whatever your name is now, when you reach God realization and become Saint so-and-so, when people pray to you and ask for your blessings, that specific little bubble will come out of the ocean and return to bless the one who is calling him. So we cease to exist because the tiny bubble becomes one with the sea, and yet we always exist. There's this beautiful image of understanding the simultaneity of time that at least I have found very graphic. Eternity is the center of the circle, and all of time exists in a perfect circle all around it. And once you enter eternity, you can step out of it to any point on the circumference of that wheel, and it all exists at the same time. And if someone somewhere calls to you in the form that you once lived, you can just slide right back into it without losing your connection with eternity. We can become all of it at the same time. And where we exist is somewhere around the spectrum of this wheel. And the more tightly we're clinging to the rim, the more narrow our perspective is. You can see that if you're standing just on the rim of the wheel, you can see a little bit forward and a little bit back, but you don't even know that the rest of the wheel exists. The closer you move toward the center point of eternity, you can see how your vision simultaneously expands. And as our awareness expands, we become conscious of the influence of the past over our existence, even the very existence of the past. The memories of this incarnation, either the memories or the feelings of previous incarnations, of deeply held inclinations that define us. And we also have a greater capacity to manifest a future that is consistent with the ideals we're embracing, because the more our perspective moves toward the center, the greater our self-definition becomes. When I was younger, before I found the spiritual path, and by the grace of God, I started reading serious self-realization literature when I was only 18. So I didn't have a long span in the wilderness, so to speak, in the desert, before something solid entered my reality. I was desperate, really, to find an enduring truth that I could really give my whole energy to. By nature, I like to do things completely. I don't enjoy kind of half-hearted effort. Recently, I've been working on helping to bring into real form a movie that's being made about Ananda. And there was this one little scene we were trying to work out, and I was... There's one person who's perfect for that scene. She's a girl in Los Angeles. But the day that we were filming, she just had commitment she couldn't break. So she said she couldn't do it. Well, I didn't even occur to me, but she's the right person for the scene. And I just kept, well, email is the way you do things these days. I just kept sending email after email with alternative after alternative after alternative. And finally, not quite a compliment, she said, "You are the most persistent person I have ever met." I thought, really? You know, how startling. Well, if you're going to do something, you just do it with everything you have. Now, my frustration before I found self-realization to begin with, Swami Kriyananda and Ananda afterwards, was I was, perhaps not exactly accurately, but I was a fanatic without a cause. I was a fanatic in the sense of a wholehearted person by temperament, but there was nothing I wanted to wholeheartedly give myself to. It's a very, very, actually agonizing position to be in, which I'm sure many of you can relate to. We know that we have this force of energy within us that is meant to be expressed. We may not be the most brilliant or capable person in the world, but what little bit we have to contribute, we're eager to contribute it. But if it's not wanted or has no outlet, or if we ourselves lack the necessary equipment in order to focus our energy and give it out, it's a very sad way to live. I think it was it Thoreau who said, you know, most men live lives of quiet desperation. I rarely think of that because it breaks my heart to hear it. But we do, because we know that we ought to be doing something, but we're not quite sure what it is, how to do it, or if we see it, we don't know how to go about manifesting it. And looking back on my early life, I couldn't have articulated it then, but what I began to understand when conditions shifted to more favorable ones is that I felt so confined, just confined. It was an existential confinement that just, there's got to be more than this. I know that I am more than I am, but I cannot find an opening. I can't find an opening in which to expand into that reality. Now, this is the lot of all of us. And the masters explain it to us very simply and very clearly. We are infinite by nature. We have become identified with a false reality. Now, false reality, or interesting juxtaposition of words, it's real because we consistently experience it. And even though we can philosophically dismiss it as a dream or an illusion or an ephemeral reality, the simple truth is it sure don't feel that way. Isn't that the case? I would go into that temple every morning with all those other women. We would have these deep experiences together, and darn if I didn't just walk out myself every single time. And I was thinking of breakfast by the time I'd walked the 100 yards, you know, from the temple to my little trailer where I lived at that time. Just all of these other forces would just hang out on the side. They say, if you take a dip in the Ganges, in, you know, certain holy places, then all of your karma will be washed away by the river. Except, as some of the masters say, it waits on the riverbed, and when you get out of the river, it just comes back in again. So you have that moment of blissful freedom. You know, when I myself went to India for the first time, and not all parts of the Ganges are real attractive to swim in, I must add, but in the opportunity to bathe in the Ganges, I was a little American intellectual about it. That's the only thing I can say. And I don't believe I actually went into the Ganges for several visits. We used to lead pilgrimages there. And finally we got up to Rishikesh, where the river was fresher and cleaner. It was a little hard in Varanasi, where they were cremating the bodies and throwing the ashes into the river. You just weren't inclined to dive in after the ashes, you know. Finally, we found a place upriver from those ghats, and it was a little better there. All of this is to say, the first time I stepped into the Ganges, you know, it was, wow, this is really happening. You know, this is not just water. This is not just swimming. There's something very real, and I couldn't explain it for anything in the world, but I experienced it. It was there. I did come out of the river, and just like coming out of the temple, there I was again. You know, this tiresome sameness of self. Now, Being a yogi on the spiritual path, the word yogi is a very interesting word. Yogi, what the definition of yogi is, of course, one who practices yoga, which means a scientific method for expanding your consciousness and realizing God. But a more subtle definition of a yogi, which is one worth contemplating, is the yogi cooperates with things as they are and works with things as they are to come to a greater reality. And that's why yoga is so perfect for our times and so perfect for Americans, because Americans are very practical. You know, we're interested in far-out ideas, but we're much more interested in what we can actually do about it. It's a cultural fact. I guess it's because we landed in a place where there was nothing. We had to build it all ourselves. We couldn't just hang around and feel great because Michelangelo had carved the David in the same city that we were in. We had to really make it happen for ourselves. So yoga, as the words really mean, are standing in reality as we presently perceive it, but then also understanding that as we presently perceive it is not the whole. We're on the outside of the wheel, and we need to understand that we can go into the center of the wheel and from the center become the whole circumference. Now, the spiritual path is this extraordinary balancing act between being a yogi and really understanding things as they are and working with them as they are, but never for a moment getting trapped in the thought that just because this is my reality now, that this will be my reality forever. And then we make a second error. I was talking to someone once when the opportunity came to take the vows that are part of the Nayaswami order. You notice that those of us who appear before you on Sundays who are light bearers wear a variety of colors. And these colors are related to various vows that we have taken. You can find out about all of this in a website called a New Renunciate Order for a New Age. It's very interesting. But the Nayaswami vow, which is the blue color that many of us wear, is for those of us who have the karmic conditions to allow us to make a total vow of sannyas, a vow of renunciation. This is a new version of what you see in India if you go and you see all the swamis walking around in their orange robes or the Buddhist monks in their red robes. This is an equivalent of that, with the slight shift that couples are allowed to take this vow together without having to renounce their marriages, which is nice, very nice. Become saints together is the way it's expressed. But I was talking to someone about the possibility of taking these vows. You can take a pilgrim vow, you can take a temporary vow, you can take a final vow. And I said, well, what would you be interested in? She said, the Nayaswami vow, which was, with all due respect, totally inappropriate. I said, why? She said, well, it's the highest vow. You know, I'm going to apply to college. I'll apply to Harvard. You know, there's advanced placement English. I'm going to take AP English. You know, just the way we think. I'm going to get the best job. I'm going to do the best this. I'm going to excel like that. Because we are trained, especially in America, God bless America, to think in terms of the external world. Whatever virtues Americans have, one of the things we excel in is the external world. You know, we have endless hot showers, and we used to have cheap gasoline and all the things that we've had here. When we went to India one year, we got caught actually in a fire. It was a festival season, and they had built this huge outdoor tent on the grounds of a temple. And the temple grounds were made out of concrete and stone, but because it was a festival time and they needed to have a place for some extra 2,000 or 3,000 people, they'd built this big tent. And India's not real big on codes and inspectors. Their sense of things is different. You know, karma is karma. It just unfolds. They don't feel that the government has to protect you from every possibility. You know, so the tent caught fire because of all the electrical systems and all the sticks and all the so on like that. And fortunately, very fortunately, it was a very orderly situation. Even though there were a few thousand people there, they all got out, and only a few people were even injured at all, and no one was killed, and so on. I was told later, oh yes, every festival season, many of the tents catch fire. It's just one of the things that happens because they're all built the same way. But when the fire department arrived, we were not in the tent itself. We were in another part of the temple, and we mostly got away. A few of our people were injured a little bit, and it was not, I mean, we didn't get away clean on that. But the fire department arrived. And the fire department was a group of men who arrived in the back of a pickup truck, and they were wearing shorts and little singleton tops, little muscle shirts. Many of them had no shoes, and they actually literally started passing buckets of water. And as it happens, these tent fires flare up and burn out really fast because they're mostly built in a stone place. So everything that was flammable burned, really in a matter of minutes, and then it was over. That was that. A few days later, they built the whole thing again. But one of our American friends were freaked out, I think is the only word for it. And when we finally got back to the hotel, everybody was just there like this, and one girl said basically, I want to go home. I want to go home to America, where we have millions of dollars worth of equipment just sitting in buildings all over the city just in case. Just in case. Because no children starve if we do that. You know, no people are lost. And we have so much material wealth. And I don't begrudge that because we earned it. You know, we made it happen by our willpower and by energy. That's why Master came to America. He really liked it. He really liked that spirit. You know, so we're very good at the external world. So we get on the spiritual path and we think, well, that's the highest vow. That's the one I'm going to take. We think about how can I paste onto this form that I carry around what it's supposed to look like to be spiritual. In the early years of Ananda Village, when all of us were just totally new at this, there was so much play acting. You know, people would arrive and they would wear nothing but white. They would speak only in soft tones. They would carry holy books around like this. And just like, well, this is what it's supposed to be spiritual, so I'll be spiritual like this. And let their hair grow matted and go barefoot in the snow. I mean, it was totally fun. You know, it was just a riot. We just made it up any way we wanted to until we gradually kind of figured out what we were really supposed to be doing. And Swami Kriyananda just benignly presided over the whole thing. There was a small group who visited us for a while who were from the Pleiades, actually. They were just there. They were marvelous people, and they were just from another planet, except for one man who described himself as the token earthling, and he would go around with them all the time. He was like their earthling guide, and they were fine. They were just, that was their idea of what they were supposed to do, because almost anything is more fun than actually being who you are, because the problem with being who you are is, well, there you are. Whenever I have taken a seclusion, I'm not very good at short seclusions, time spent in silence and solitude, because it takes about 3 days to get rid of her before I can really just begin to enjoy the expanded possibilities of solitude with God. So the most challenging, oddly enough, and it's right there in the Bhagavad Gita, it's right there in the Gita, is that you have to do what you were born to do. And so much of our lives we spend wishing we were born to do something else. You know, and people nowadays, there's this big thing about you have to find the word is your passion, which I totally endorse. Life is really, really dull if you're not passionate about what you're doing. But the problem is, probably what you're doing is what you're supposed to be doing. Because if you weren't supposed to be doing it, you probably wouldn't be doing it. If it wasn't your karma to have had this happen to you, it wouldn't have happened to you. And if your life is, as many of our lives are, because all lives have this sort of icky middle part where it's just not interesting and it's not spectacular and nobody in history is going to remember you and there's just nothing much to say. We're just plodding along, working on the only thing that actually matters, which is shifting our consciousness from limitation to bliss. And we can't shift our consciousness from limitation to bliss by wearing clothes or by taking vows or by, I mean, wearing particular clothes or taking particular vows or referring yourself, you know, dropping the personal pronoun. Oh, I forgot that one. The people who would come and speak only of this unit of consciousness. That was one of my favorites. This unit of consciousness is going in now to have dinner. This unit of consciousness, so that I don't say I ever. I mean, I appreciated the fanaticism that would lead people to do that. I mean, that's after my own heart. The problem with it is it doesn't work. The only thing that actually works is to build an expansive consciousness from the hand that you dealt yourself. You don't remember having dealt it yourself, but there we are standing in it. In this body, in this culture, whatever culture you're from, whatever language you speak, whatever children you have or don't have, whatever orientation, talents, lack of them, laziness, whatever it is, you absolutely cannot go forward except from right where you're standing. And no matter how nifty it looks over there, the only way to get there is inch by inch by inch. And the Gita tells it to us very bluntly. Even if you succeed at someone else's duty, it won't serve you. Only when, and I love the way Yogananda puts this, when we fight the battle for joy right where we're standing. Right where we're standing. If we're standing there, I remember that often. I'm not a very good housekeeper at all. I don't like it, I mean. I can do it, but I don't like it. And I'm standing there washing dishes, you know. I just developed this, I mean, absolutely irrational aversion to washing the dishes. And I rarely cook, and David and I just live so, you know, small in that house. And still, there they are, this pile of dishes. And it's just mind-numbing work as far as I'm concerned. It's crazy, crazy to react so hard to it. But I do. And I long for a cook and a dishwasher, you know, or an ashram where they'll feed me every meal, all those different things. But then I just remember, where will you find God? Where do you expect to find God except right where you are? Where do you think God is except standing within you right in this moment? Where are you going to fight the battle for joy except right where you're standing? The problem with the spiritual path is it's so simple that we wish it were more complicated. And so lacking that, we try to make it more complicated. But the actual fact is, who am I in this moment? What am I remembering? Am I with God? Am I fighting the battle of joy right where I'm standing? The Dharma that I have is the Dharma that's been given to me, and only by facing it with my whole heart will I ever find out who I really am. And as Swamiji told us over and over, what bliss, what bliss, what bliss. From joy I came, for joy I live, in sacred joy I melt again. That's what we're destined to know, and that is the only duty assigned to us. God bless you.